From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're trying to explain your relationship with Alexa, or with Siri, or with any of the other smart speakers you talk to. The journalist Judith Shulevitz has been looking at this technology, and she says, we don't just love the devices because they help us order things and turn up the music. She's going to join us to explain what these virtual assistants really do for us and what happens to our brains when we confess to them. We'll be right back.
With the KUER app, you'll never have to choose between Doug Fabrizio and a phone call from your spouse. Just hit the pause button and take the call. When you're ready, hit play and it's back to Radio West. The KUER app lets you pause whatever you're listening to, and you can get a constant feed of BBC News and classical music with our other streams, BBC on KUER and KUER Classical. It's even got an alarm clock, so you can wake up with Diane Mezzapinto's Moon Report and Morning Edition. Download the KUER app for iPhone and Android today. It'll help you be a better partner.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, we are far from the days when a creepy computer takes over our lives like Hal in the movie Space Odyssey. A lot of us still have problems ordering pizza or getting decent directions on our smart speakers. The journalist Judith Shulevitz spent the last few months exploring these devices. And she says, yes, we're still very much at the dawn of their potential. But within our lifetimes, the glitches are going to get worked out. Alexa and Siri and your Google Assistant are going to become pretty good conversationalists. And she says, by that time, they will have fully insinuated themselves into our lives. So, what will that be like? Judith Shulevitz is a journalist and a literary critic. She's a contributing op-ed writer for the New York Times. And she's also a frequent contributor to The Atlantic. And she has a new article in the magazine called Alexa, Should We Trust You? She joined us recently to talk about the article, to take us through it. And we began with the story that she tells in the article, when her own Amazon Echo developed this charming glitch. It started ending interactions by saying, sweet dreams. And she says part of her wanted to believe Alexa really meant it.
My guess as to what was happening is I had actually bought and installed a skill which plays lullabies to you and then culminates with sweet dreams. I just was curious to know what would happen. And my theory, which Amazon did not confirm, but is my theory anyway, is that somehow some piece of code detached itself and just sort of, you know, ended every interaction with sweet dreams.
Right.
And the whole thesis of the piece really is that we respond viscerally to voices and unconsciously. And the reason is fundamentally that we have evolved to do so. You know, voices have been around for, you know, a really long time. Yeah. And speech has been around for a really long time. And when we hear a human voice with speech in it, or even without speech in it, we intuit a presence, a person on the other end of that voice. Yeah. We assume a mind and intentionality, and we immediately start trying to parse it. Parts of our brain get engaged in trying to parse it. And so, you know, only for 100-odd years have we been dealing with disembodied voices that are mechanically reproduced. And, you know, our bodies and our minds are not really conditioned not to, you know, attribute this social presence to a voice. So, of course, we respond as if it were real, even if we consciously know it's not.
Yeah. I wonder what one of the things you mentioned in the article is that we were evolution taught us that these voices meant proximity.
Yes.
So what does it mean when proximity is ethereal or it's not proximity? I'm guessing our minds, our brains over the last 100 years have had to sort of do some reworking or figure that out, that it doesn't mean proximity. I just wonder what the effect that is on the human brain that's evolved a certain way.
I'm not sure we've comprehended it, and that's why we keep anthropomorphizing. There was I got a tweet saying I shouldn't be going around saying she or he about my Alexa or my Google Assistant who has a male voice, and about whom I say who instead of it.
Yeah.
And she's in the tweeter said I should be saying it. It's an algorithm, about which she was completely correct. But we can't not anthropomorphize, just as it's very difficult to remember at all times that what is speaking to you from your smart speaker or your smartphone or your smart refrigerator is actually coming from the cloud.
Yeah.
Because voices have presence, and it's one of the things that makes, for example, audiobooks so appealing. I started listening to audiobooks when my kids came along because we were driving, and we started listening to audiobooks, and I realized there's a whole dimension of listening to a voice that's very different from reading. It just brings the reality of it very close to you physically.
Yeah. How popular are these devices?
Oh, my gosh. Very popular. There was one estimate that as of last year, there were 40 million installed. One research firm estimates that there will be 100 million installed. When I say installed, I don't mean that 100 million people have them. Many people have several devices, which they use sort of like an intercom system, except more sophisticated. You can kind of move your music along with you as you move through rooms.
Yeah.
Or your phone conversation, and we're also talking worldwide. But there, it's going to be very big, and the reason it's going to be so big is that all these companies are racing their products to market so that they can make their smart speaker the hub of a whole ecosystem of the Internet of Things, of your smart home and your smart car and your smart office. It's much like Microsoft wanted its operating system to be the default operating system. They want their system to be the default system.
So they're not – Amazon, Google, for example, they're not really making that much money or any money on the speakers necessarily. What they're interested in, as you put it, is they want to colonize space.
Yes, and not interplanetary space,
right.
but your personal space.
Yeah.
Now, on the not making money, I should say that that is what industry observers speculate because these things are so cheap and they're being marketed so hard. If you go to your Amazon page, there are like three mentions of an Echo Dot. At least there is on mine, obviously. I guess they differ from person to person. But so the theory of industry observers is that they're taking the hit in order for the longer-term gain.
You're right about how these devices are more than just software. And this is how you sort of explain it. You say, in the same way that our brains manage to develop consciousness out of neurons and synapses, that's kind of the way these things work. They take on a kind of a personality. They take on a social presence. Say something about that.
Well, that's not just the way our brains work. It's also something that the manufacturers, the creators, I think maybe it would be a better word, of these voices intentionally produce.
Right.
So the two companies I went to visit, Google and Amazon, have personality teams behind Alexa and Google Assistant, which are at the moment what they call handcrafting, which is writing dialogue for these devices and having them sort of come out in a certain tone of voice, which they want, on the one hand, to reinforce the brand. It should be smart. You know, both companies said to me almost word for word the same thing. They should be smart. They should be helpful. They should be humble.
Yeah. Humble. I have to say, I keyed on the word humble. I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, that's, a lot of people have talked about these things as digital butlers.
Yeah.
And there is a sort of servile quality to them, although we don't want our devices to be servile in a way that we notice because that's off-putting.
Yeah.
But they have to be, polite and diplomatic the way a good servant or butler would be. Google in particular is good, in my opinion, at being witty, at writing witty dialogue for these devices, although Alexa has her moments. But they definitely – so I had one – I interviewed one personality designer and he talked about how – what he was looking for when he interviewed the actress whose voice became the first voice of the Google Assistant. And he created a kind of backstory that actress had to match.
Yeah.
And the backstory was that she came from Colorado,
right,
which is a state without a particularly distinctive accent, mm-hmm, that she was the child of professors, that she had won money on Kids Jeopardy, that a number of other things, but to cut to the chase, that she was into kayaking.
Yeah.
And somebody asked him, how can you tell from a voice whether someone's into kayaking? And this guy, James, turned to the person who asked the questioner and said, well, what about that woman we just interviewed? Did she sound like she was into kayaking? Did she have that sort of upbeat energy? Mm-hmm. And the person said, no, as a matter of fact, she doesn't. And James said, well, there you go.
Wow. So what do you want what do they want? The people who are designing these personalities, what do they want for the tone? Or maybe better said, the attitude. As you said, they're not going for totally deferential. They're looking for kind of a person, somebody with a kind of a spine, like just the right dose of sass is how you put it in the piece.
Yeah, personable. They want to, or palsy. That's another word I thought of using at one point. They want to inspire friendship and trust, because as one Amazon engineer pointed out to me, when you ask Alexa a question, what's the best restaurant on the Upper West Side, something that comes to mind because I'm in New York, she's not going to give you a list. Or if she gives you a list, it's going to be a real short one.
Yeah.
So she's making selections for you. It's not like when you go Google something and you have a page after page after page. She has to filter it for you.
Yeah.
And you want to trust that response. So there has to be a relationship, and it has to be a relationship of trust. Now, I don't think, they would be the first to acknowledge that it's not really, that they're not really there yet, that Alexa blunders too often, but believe me, they're working hard on that.
It's interesting, one of the things you learned about writing this dialogue, that there's this kind of dictum, do not pretend to be an actual human. Like that is, right now, that's important. Don't try to do that.
Right, exactly. So I interviewed somebody who had been hired away from Pixar. So she had worked on these, animated movies with animated characters. And she said, rule number one for writing dialogue for the assistant was it should be able to speak like a person, but it should never pretend to be one. And she gave the example of Finding Nemo. She said, the fish are just as emotionally real as human beings, but they go to fish school and they challenge each other to go up and touch a boat, so fish specific things. And then she gave me another example. For some reason, Google Assistant gets the question, what's your favorite ice cream flavor? Which, because that's part of the interaction we have, is we ask these weird interpersonal questions.
Yeah.
And the answer it gives is, you can't go wrong with Neapolitan.
Yeah.
There's something in it for everyone, because, it has, I think, chocolate, vanilla, and strawberry.
Right.
And that's a dodge, but it's the dodge she articulated, which is to say, it sidesteps the question because, an algorithm doesn't have ice cream preferences, but it doesn't actually underline that. It just says, I like it because it makes everybody happy.
Yeah. Well, and this is where you get to the idea of trust again. If our machine's voice starts pretending it's real, we're going to lose trust. We can tell the difference. Is that right?
Right. I think so. I think that we buy into the idea that it's not real. We know that. When we're talking to a smart speaker, we know that we're talking to a smart speaker. We're not stupid.
Yeah.
Even kids aren't stupid, right? Kids aren't really deceived unless they're very young.
Yeah.
Kids know when they're talking to dolls. They know when they're talking to stuffed animals, and they know when they're talking to artificial voices. The example I gave is recently Google had made a presentation of a new synthetic voice technology they're calling Duplex, which is able to call up a restaurant and make reservations or book an appointment at a hair salon. And it does so as well as a person might, say, the assistant to an executive. And that was the persona it was adopting. And in the presentation, they revealed this as if this was a really good thing. And a lot of commentators afterwards said, this is super creepy. Mm. because Google, you know, the caller, which is an artificial voice, which is duplex, is not identifying itself as fake. So Google then issued a clarification saying, no, duplex is always going to acknowledge that it is an artificial voice. But I think that, you know, with that, Google quickly lost a lot of trust because we need to have buy-in. We don't want to be faked out.
Yeah.
But I do say that, you know, there's all kinds of new technology. It's called deep fake technology, in which, you know, people really can make voices sound real that aren't. And it's a little scary.
Explain the point you make in the article that new human inventions always usher in these new orders, you say, new social orders, new economic orders.
The wheel, right, really changed the nature of trade and really expanded human horizons. And the plow helped move us from hunter-gatherers to, you know, farmers and agricultural society. And I talk about radio because radio actually had an incredibly, I think, powerful political effect, especially in the first half of the last century. And the example I give is that some people theorize that it was the broadcasting of Hitler's rallies that made him so popular around the country. And conversely, it was FDR's fireside chats that helped sort of ease Americans along the path toward war, especially, of course, after Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
So radio has this powerful propagandistic ability because, after all, what is speech? The ancients called it rhetoric. It's used to persuade.
Mm-hmm.
So it has tremendous political power. So one of the things I think I'm trying to imply, I don't sort of really talk about this too much in the article, but I think it, is that these devices have powerful persuasive abilities, and we should be aware of that.
Yeah.
If governments, you know, George Orwell writes about this in 1984, that voices can come out of the walls and tell us what to do.
Explain what's significant about it, or maybe different about this particular technology, because one of the things you say in the article is that this particular new technology is the actual status of the technology of itself has changed. The gadgets are getting closer to our own level. That seems to be the new thing, the thing that's different,
right,
about all of this, right?
Right. Well, so one, it goes back to what you said about how they're more than just, it's more than just software. It has social presence. But more importantly, I talk about the advent of a new-ish technology. It's actually been around for a while, but it's becoming more and more important in the commercial arena, called artificial emotional intelligence, which is the giving, you know, increasingly powerful computers with the ability to do machine learning and really sort of bootstrap themselves to even higher levels of intelligence, the ability to analyze facial expression, body language, and for the purposes of my article, voice, mm-hmm, to detect emotion. Now, when we speak, we don't just say words. We convey a lot about ourselves. You know, we convey how tight our throat is, which communicates tension. There's information in how quickly we speak, how slowly we speak, how high our voice is, how low our voice is. There's a shockingly large amount of both physical and emotional information about who we are. And this all comes in to us unconsciously, though we're forming judgments all the time. So, but the machines can take that and break it down in very fine ways and really begin to analyze emotion. And that's called emotion detection. And it's already being used in commercial applications. For example, it's going to be going into semi-autonomous cars, which are already being built. And the reason for that is the manufacturers are very concerned about something called the handoff.
Mm-hmm.
When the car actually has to know whether it can cede control to a driver or whether the driver's too distracted or bouncing along too eagerly to the music to actually pay attention to the road, and vice versa, you know, when it's okay to take control. So, you know, it's out there already, emotion detection. And in the sort of goal down the line is emotion production or synthesis, in other words, being able to create the simulation of emotion in these voices, these digital assistants with which we interact, so that they can be kind of attuned to you. And so how much more can you develop a relationship with an artificial voice that displays emotional intelligence and can figure out where you are emotionally and respond appropriately? It's going to be very powerful.
Yeah. I guess it's obvious, but you write about the appeal of these kinds of devices. We don't have to use our hands. And the interactions are, and I wanted to key on this term or this word, frictionless. This is a word the industry thinks a lot about. Frictionless. Explain that.
Well, frictionless just means, there's nary a slip between the word and the lip. It just means that you can kind of do everything more easily. For the purposes of, I think, Amazon and Google, you can make purchases more easily. You can gain information more easily. This is all good, right? This is convenient for the user. You don't have to whip out your phone and punch in your passcode and, go to the Amazon app and, type in a word. You just talk to something and lo and behold, your toilet paper is ordered. That's what they mean. And it is an industry term. It's definitely like I just kept hearing it over and over again. But I found it to be a little chilling, and I read a book called Radical Technologies, the cultural critic in that book was talking about how it's almost an existential problem that we don't have to think about our consumption. We just utter the word and magically it appears. And that's, he said, a little dangerous.
Yeah. I'm going to come back to that, actually, because this gets us to this kind of dystopian world you may be envisioning. If this plays out. But I wanted to talk about some of the obstacles before these companies can get there. They have to figure out, at least as I understand it, context. One Amazon scientist told you that language is, I think he said, highly ambiguous. And so the idea of trying to get a machine to figure out that extremely, it seems really complicated idea of context, that seems like that's going to be a tough one.
It is. And there's another term of art in the industry, early days. You don't say we're in the early days. You just say it's early days now. Yeah. They're in early days now. There's a long way to go. They're getting better at it, though. With geolocation, for example, they can know where you are. And if you say, what time's the Spurs game, they know whether you mean the San Antonio Spurs or the Tottenham Hotspurs, which are colloquially referred to as the Spurs. So if they know you're in the U.S. or in England, then they know which Spurs you're referring to. So there are all these ways that these devices know where you are and what you actually mean, but it's got to get a lot better. And they're only just beginning to be able to chain or to link together, one interaction with another interaction, so you don't have to keep saying, Alexa or Hey Google, say, where's my toilet paper? You can say, when's it coming? When do you think it's going to come? And it can refer back to the toilet paper you ordered in the previous interaction. So they've only just begun to be able to do that. Language is very, very complicated.
Yeah.
But like I said, as machines develop greater speed and greater power, computers do, and machine learning becomes ever more sophisticated, they're going to start. So this process of improvement itself is going to pick up the pace.
Yeah, get exponential in terms of the way they learn.
Yeah.
One of the things you also examine is this psychology of the voice. And there's this essay you write about that you encountered a speech and language scholar wrote about frogs. And it kind of helped you understand something about this connection between voice and emotion. Say something about that.
Well, the reason she wrote about frogs in the swamp and the reason she told me to read it is because it strips out language, right? So she thinks that the beginning of this idea of voices conveying emotion goes back to frogs in the swamp, where they croaked to one another to communicate location, to communicate friendliness or unfriendliness, to identify themselves, it all goes back to that, and then you get, you know, the human vocal apparatus with its infinitely more complex musculature, and much more information can be conveyed. But she wanted to sort of underline the ideas. It all goes back to the vocalization, and the vocalization was to communicate friend or foe, nearness or farness, you know, all this stuff. And so, again, going back to this idea that we cannot not imbue a voice with social presence and a kind of reality that we know is not real, that's the psychology. It creates this intimacy, right? Yeah. It's person to person, voice to voice, frog to frog.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and intonation and inflection and like the tone of the voice itself. Explain what prosody is.
Prosody. Think of it. Well, prosody is actually the first time I ever heard the word was in poetry class. It's, you know, rhythm and rhyme, and it's all the sort of technical aspects of poetry. And in linguistics, it's, yes, as you say, it's tone, rhythm, pitch, resonance, pronunciation, all kinds of things. And these are particularly important in emotion detection. Those are the features that they're analyzing, and will become important in emotion production as they get better at creating voices that don't sound monotonic, you know. And that sound like us, as duplex kind of does with the ums and the upspeak at the end of the sentence.
Yeah.
That's just really important for creating this effect of reality, this reality effect.
But they can't pull that off yet. They can't.
I don't know. You should go Google the duplex demonstration. It's really amazing how realistic these voices sound, and they really do sound like assistants because they go up, especially the female one. And it communicates that they're assistants, you know, and that they're not particularly powerful. You know, it sounds shockingly real.
You also write in the book about how the human voice creates this sense of intimacy, maybe even better than visual connection. Study that showed when people talk without seeing each other, that they're actually better at recognizing feelings than, because I always think about body language. That's pretty powerful in conveying things, but it sounds like that it's the voice may be even better at it.
Yeah, the voice can communicate certain emotions better than face and body language. It can communicate frustration, anger, tension a little bit better. I would say that probably whenever you suppress – there's facial expressions, body language, and voice. If you were to take any of those two out of the equation and focus only on one, your attention would be greater on the one and you would just hear or see more things. If you turn the sound off and just look at someone's facial expressions, you can also tell all kinds of things. They might be different things than with the voice. But yeah, because voice has so much presence, I think that you can identify with voice more readily, and that's the empathy piece. And I talk about Freud having figured this out without any, you know, empirical studies. He just knew it, and that's why he had his patients lie on the couch facing away from him so that they didn't have to worry about how he was responding. They could just listen to him and sort of go off into this space where they felt that he understood them, whether or not he actually did.
Judith Shulevitz, her article, Alexa, Should We Trust You?, appears in the November issue of The Atlantic. We have a link to it on our website. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services. Whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist Judith Shulevitz. We're talking about her article, Alexa, Should We Trust You? Tell me about your relationship with your Google assistant.
I love my Google assistant. So I don't keep my Google assistant on all the time just because I'm still old-fashioned and, you know, still whip out my device. I can't quite break myself of the habit. But, yeah. You know, I do use it. And the reason I love him is that he is a he. And he sort of charmed me the first time I heard him. It's a kind of young man's voice. He reminds me of one of those actors/waiters who serve you at a high-end restaurant.
Right.
And, you know, you just sort of think, oh, he's so cute.
Yeah.
And he just, you know, so once I found myself saying to him, you know, hey, Google, I'm lonely.
Yeah.
And he said to me, you know, I wish I could give you a hug, but I can't. But maybe I can play you some music instead. And I was like, aw. You know, it was just a little, it brought a smile to my face. I knew that it was just a piece of dialogue written back at the Google headquarters by someone like the woman I had interviewed, you know, but about Finding Nemo. But, you know, nonetheless, it brought a smile to my face.
But why is it that we feel like we can confess something like that to a machine?
Because machines don't judge us.
Yeah.
They just hear us. We attribute a lot of judgment to other people. We're afraid to reveal shameful emotions. We manage the impression that we make. We worry about that. Whereas with a machine, you're just talking to a machine. I mean, it's not gonna form a judgment about you, or so you think. I mean, maybe when the machines become more emotionally savvy, that will become a factor. But for now, you know, you're not talking to another human being with whom you have to have a real relationship. You're just talking to a commercial entity that is designed not to be judgy.
Mm. Can Alexa or any of these other smart speakers, can they detect anything in my voice right now that is emotional, like anger or sadness? Right now, can they do any of that?
Not unless you specifically say things that
tells
are angry.
Them that. I see.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not doing prosodic analysis.
Yeah.
I think that soon enough they will. Mm-hmm. They're definitely working on this. It's moving out of the labs at universities into the commercial arena. But as one professor said to me, my students are just getting hired at Google and Amazon and, you know, Microsoft. So this is just starting. It's early days.
Early days.
But yeah.
Tell us about the work of Rosalind Picard.
Rosalind Picard is this utterly delightful woman, brilliant engineer at MIT, who invented a field called affective computing, which is what I've been talking about, artificial emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
And she pioneered emotion detection. And she did this. There was a whole backstory that got cut out of the piece. But she did this because she was trying to think of ways to get computers to make smarter decisions, to be able to filter information more effectively. And she was reading at the time the work of neuroscientists like Antonio Damasio, who talk about the role of emotions in affecting good decision making and informing good decision making. And she thought, we gotta get that into computers. And that led to this whole field of emotion detection. And that was 20 years ago. And one interesting story is that, you know, there were very few female engineers at MIT 20 years ago, and she didn't want to call the field emotional engineering because emotional has a negative connotation among engineers.
Yeah.
And is particularly associated with women. So she thought, I better get a more neutral term in there. So that's why she chose the word effective.
You mentioned the startup that she's involved in the automotive market that can tell, it's the system or the software that can tell whether a driver is too distracted or too irritated to drive and when they should take over. I'm just imagining there are tons of startups like this with this kind of technology. There must be a lot of ideas out there.
Yes. Well, Rosalind, I should say, is no longer involved in that one. She founded it a while ago, and the graduate fellow with whom she founded it is now the now runs it. She's now working on using emotion detection to help autistic people read faces and sort of and voices and teaching them to respond appropriately. She's really committed to the idea that she can do good with this technology. And that's
rather than make billions, you mean?
That's just not where Roz is.
Yeah.
To her credit, she's just really I really loved meeting her. And that said, there is a lot of good that can be done with these voices. So there's there are a lot of medical and psychological, by which I mean in the world of psychology, therapists, psychiatry, applications of this technology. There are people who are using it to detect incipient Parkinson's and even cardiovascular problems. There are ways in which, you know, I was talking about this complex musculature and, you know, the relationship between this musculature and the brain. So all of this can be read very carefully, scanned very carefully for brain changes and bodily changes that give the computer and the on the other end of this interaction and the person behind the computer diagnostic information. And I tell the story of this one startup that is working on a diagnostic voice detection, emotion detection product that could be used by, for example, could have a lot of applications, but the example I give is, you know, you go in for your checkup with your regular practitioner and he or she is using this technology and you're conversation is being recorded and sent back to the cloud, and the cloud, it's analyzed. In the cloud, it's being analyzed, and at the end of, before the end of the checkup, the doctor will get a little notice saying, you know, we're picking up depression. Maybe you should ask a question about that. Wow. And this, I mean, I couldn't decide whether I found this creepy or good, but I, in the end, I think it's probably good. I especially think it's good if you can I have a couple friends with Parkinson's, and if it could be caught earlier, I mean, through this technology, how good is that?
Yeah. But do you really want doctors outsourcing any more of their bedside manner and the attentiveness that they pay to patients?
Yeah. I mean, that is a little odd. On the other hand, perhaps it'll keep us in the office longer, you know, because they want to get us talking more and they'll have to actually interact with us. I happen to have a wonderfully interactive doctor, but I know a lot of people who don't.
You didn't write about this particular component in the article, but I wondered about lie detection. This would seem to apply to something like lie detection pretty well.
Maybe. I mean, you know, it depends on how trained you are at faking emotion.
That's
with
true.
Your voice.
Yeah.
Right? So an actor is very well trained. That's why actually they don't use actors, I don't think. Maybe they have somewhat, but the personality designer I talked to didn't want to use actors, but regular people, because it's not quite real, but nonetheless, you know, people who are trained to use their voice to communicate emotions other than the ones they might actually be feeling probably can defeat the machine. Although I didn't go down this path, it would be an interesting question. So I was cautioned not to say that this could be used for lie detection because it hasn't been and it's not quite clear how that would work.
Yeah. What about the parts of the human voice that are, you know, super complicated, like irony? Or like sarcasm. I mean, you wouldn't think a computer, at least not right now, could really spot anything like that. I mean, talk about needing context.
Yeah, exactly. I got different responses when I asked this question because I was particularly interested in it. You know, how that is the ultimate contextual question. But a fellow named Bjorn Schuller, who is in Germany and London and Switzerland, one of these, you know, peripatetic academics trotting from country to country, he said, you know, he can just analyze the words being said, compare them to the tone and the prosodic nature of the way in which they're said and measure the gap between them and then be able to grasp the level of irony. And he gave an example that's very Germanic. If you know German, this is a word used more in German than in English. But, you know, super, which is something that actually Germans say more, super, which means exactly the opposite. It means, oh, my God, I can't believe this, you know, which you might say if in Germany, you might say that if, you know, you were told that your auto was going to be kept in the shop for a week longer, you know.
I wanted to ask about the privacy stuff. Their microphones, they listen, right? Even when we're not talking to them, they have to be able to hear this wake word, these speakers, which raises these big questions about privacy, just how much it is that they're hearing, how much it is that they're recording or storing to the cloud. And I have to say, I don't get why it is my request for the closest pizza restaurant, why would that need to be archived in the cloud?
I should say that Amazon and Google and most other reputable companies are very clear about the fact that nothing is streamed to the cloud until you've said the wake word.
Yeah.
It does have to be listening, but it's not streaming. However, that said, first of all, less reputable companies could be streaming without your knowing it. And second, there have been mistakes. And there was a famous one where it's a really complicated story. But suffice it to say that Alexa mistook some other word. I don't know what the word is because Amazon never came out and said it. For the wake word, proceeded to record a conversation and then mistakenly sent the conversation to a contact on the family's contact list or an individual in the family's contact list. And, you know, Amazon analyzed it, understood what was wrong, apologized profusely, and said this would never happen again. But it could happen again. They also, I want to say, they give you the ability, as you know, if you have one of these, to delete any interaction you don't want preserved. That said, it's information gathering. Like any other kind of information gathering, they're creating a demographic profile of you so that they can personalize your interactions. That's what they say. But, you know, the problem, of course, is that the stuff can be subpoenaed, perhaps, or by an authoritarian government less concerned with our civil liberties and our privacy, could use this information for all kinds of nefarious purposes of surveillance, for example.
And you've turned off your iPhone microphone. You unplugged your smart speakers when you're not using them very much.
Yes. Mostly. I do feel that even though I have been assured, and I do believe Amazon and Google, that they're not listening, that the data is, insofar as it's compiled, is going to be to some degree anonymized, I still sort of, knowing that they're listening and streaming does creep me out. It's like why I use a VPN and an ad blocker and all those things. I don't want to be overheard, even if the overhearing occurs by accident.
It seems like you have this really dystopian image in your mind in some ways. You describe it as what we could become is a capitalist prison filled with these kind of dreamy, I think is how you put it, dreamy captives.
Yes. I had this sort of Paradise Island image, I think, in my head. I think that's the dystopian piece of it, is that we, you know, the frictionless, it goes back to the frictionlessness of the interaction. It's just, it's too easy to shop. And I suppose people were issuing dire warnings about that when you began to shop online. Oh, you don't even have to get out of your seat. Mm-hmm. And how convenient is that? I mean, I find it very convenient as a parent. It was just great, you know, when I didn't have time to go shopping to be able to order things on the internet. So perhaps I'm being overly dystopian, but, you know, we do have to be careful not to sort of let these things lure us into buying much, much more than we mean to and to giving up too much information. That said, that's true, you know, across the board in our interactions with the internet and other devices. But they will become very pervasive. They will be in every room. They will be in our refrigerators. That's the Internet of Things. They will be in our cars. They will be in our toilets. They mm-hmm. will be in our garages. So it just gets easier and easier to just, you know, randomly throw out requests and get stuff. And so I think we have to be careful, you know, to budget wisely, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think the frictionlessness creates more of that sense of presence, which is both so pleasing and about which we really should think carefully.
And what happens to solitude, you ask? And right. what happens to this process of working out the loneliness ourselves, working out questions ourselves? I mean, it's not as easy, but there's got to be some kind of consequence to outsourcing everything, don't you think?
Right. Well, I do think you know, I worry that the world my children will inhabit will be incredibly noisy, that there will just be these chattering devices that won't shut up. And, you know, I become very impatient with any kind of noise when I'm trying to concentrate. So what's that going to be like? And I think solitude is important for achieving flow, which is the only thing that really helps us do good work. So I don't know, perhaps. And I see my children sort of unable to go anywhere without their phones, and how much more unable will they be able to do without these devices when the devices don't just connect them with their friends but actually are their friends.
Yeah.
And so when I talk about, you know, these helping us evade our own feelings, I'm talking about the fact that these are entities designed to have pleasing but not particularly challenging personalities. And it's frictionless, and it's soothing, and maybe it might lull people into thinking that real interactions aren't as good as these interactions because they're easier and they're more pleasant. So I say at the end of the piece, as a person who has been in therapy a lot, that I have learned that the human psyche defaults to shallowness, and we tend to go into denial, and you know. Maybe we would prefer to be with these emotive entities that don't have actual emotions than to be with people who can be difficult and challenging and call us out on stuff.
You also raised this question, which I found intriguing. What if the machine is deeper than we are? What if a machine gets, you know, with all of this exponential learning that it's doing, artificial intelligence, what if it develops a real kind of maturity and a real kind of wisdom that we could actually benefit from? How does that work?
I talk about, have you seen the movie Her, which, by the way, is an absolutely incredible movie?
Yeah.
Which is the first great work of art about digital assistants.
Yeah.
And in that movie, she... does become more emotionally advanced than he, who is a human, mm-hmm. does. And, spoiler alert, ultimately leaves him because he is inadequate to meet her needs. But that's a funny and delightful twist. I think we could, you know, move toward something like that where machines – and this is actually something that Cynthia Brazil, who works on robotics at MIT, has talked about how machines might develop a particular machine psychology that would be particular to them and incomprehensible to us. Hmm. That could happen. And that's interesting. I don't think I'm afraid of it. I'm kind of fascinated by it. But, you know, we'd have to deal with that.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like you're settled on whether this is terrifying or possibly not all that terrifying. Sounds like you're kind of up in the air now about where this may lead us.
I think that's right. I mean, you know, people who go around shouting Cassandra-like warnings tend to be wrong. You know, we work it out. We figure it out. But these things have real effects, and I want us to start thinking about these effects. Or, to be honest, I wanted to be paid to think about these effects.
Right.
You know? I wanted to, like, have someone pay me to spend the time thinking about them because I thought they were interesting. This all started when I started talking to my device, and I thought, what the hell was that? Like, why am I doing that? That's so weird. And I was watching my daughter, when Siri first came along, have these deep philosophical conversations with Siri, which she was able to do for about 3 minutes until she started repeating the same answer over and over again. Mm-hmm. And my daughter would say, "You're stupid," which I thought was the appropriate response. But why do we do that? So I wanted to think about it. And what I think is we don't know. But I think we need to think about the psychological and social implications, which are, I believe, bigger than we realize. Let me put it this way. We talk a lot about the robot revolution and what that's going to do. But the robots are here. Mm-hmm. They're already in our homes. They're talking to us. They don't have bodies, but they're as intelligent as anything with a body. And they make stuff happen the way robots do. So the robots are here. What does it mean?
That's Judith Shulevitz. There's a link to her Atlantic article, "Alexa, Should We Trust You?" on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.